session number 24610, Reel 6.
Mr. Guest, Reel 6. We're talking about when you first joined the 1st Battalion. I might not mention it was the 1st Battalion Royal Norfolk Regiment. You were in the Assault Pioneer Platoon. Could you describe these bunkers or dugouts, the sort of typical nature of them, what they look like and everything else?
Typical, yeah. I would say, if one can imagine a hillside going up at about roughly 45 degrees or perhaps a little less, you cut into the hillside and it left you sort of a triangular hole in vertical section. So you've got, say, like a 4 foot wall of earth at the back, and obviously as you move the earth out, it left this wedge-shaped hole, shall I say, with the thick end of the wedge at the back of the hill. The dirt that was dug out was loaded into sandbags, and the sides of the earth were levelled out here and there to obviously to take sandbag walls, and then usually you'd have whatever one could pinch, I suppose, for a door. Usually an old blanket or something similar to keep the wind out. Inside, we made bunk beds out of pickets, barbed wire pickets lashed together, and with telephone wire, and also telephone wire crisscrossed across these pickets, so it made some semblance of a bed. If you happen to be in the machine gun platoon, then the beds were a little bit more sophisticated. These were made of wire pickets, just the same, but instead of having signal wire crisscrossed or woven across the frame, they used the ammunition belts from a Browning, which were of a canvas type thing, like a webbing belt, and these were made quite substantial bed. Occasionally we might be lucky enough to, when we moved into the line, of course, a similar sort of thing happened, but we moved into second-hand bunkers that were already there, made by other people.
Now, this reserve area, this wouldn't be the Peacock Hills or the Pike Oak Reservoir area, would it? Or was it actually in the Sami Chon?
That I can't be sure of, because I never really ever got my bearings whilst we were in reserve. It was a very large valley.
Was it from this reserve area that you went forward into the line for,
yes,
where you were captured?
Yeah.
That would be the Peacock Hills then,
yeah.
Peacock Hills, as they called them.
Mm, mm.
What were you actually doing there? You mentioned road building. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, we used to get gangs of us. Being a lance corporal, I'd have probably half a dozen men. And we'd get a 3-ton truck, and we'd go down to the M-gym and load small boulders onto the back of the truck, bring them back and use them as a base course for the roads that we were building. This happened a few times whilst we were in reserve. We also did a bit of battle training to keep us honed.
Anything new
in battle skills? No, I don't think so, really. The art that we'd learnt in Hong Kong on the course stood us in fairly good stead, and we didn't have, I don't think we had the backup to use a lot of explosives. We kept this for the, shall I say, the real thing.
What about the food you got? Can we talk about that a bit?
Food was American sea rations.
What were they?
These were a box of rations, all tin food, and there would be three small tins about the size of a small Heinz bean tin, I suppose about the size of a normal drinking mug. They would have things in like beans with frankfurter chunks. So these were baked beans with in tomato sauce, with lumps of sausage in. We would get meatballs in gravy, which were like, well, it's self-explanatory really. Meatballs in gravy. It's as simple as that. We'd get hot corned beef hash, which everybody hated. I've seen chaps throw corned beef hash away. They didn't like it. There used to be a bit of bartering going on because some men used to like some things and some men used to like others, and they would swap and change with them to try and get the best of the rations. There was three tins of meat. There was also a tin of a utility pack, which consisted of a small flat tin of jam, two or three cracker biscuits, I can't be sure which, probably two cracker biscuits, a sweet biscuit, a couple of sweets, a small square of chocolate, a book of matches, and two sheets of toilet paper. These were in a little round tin, about the same size as the others, 2.5 inches in diameter, 3.75 inches long, and that you got the meat tins. Obviously, you open with a normal type tin opener. Actually, we used to wear these around the neck with a dog tags. There was a little blade that folded out from a flat piece of metal. And you rocked it backwards and forwards on top of the tin and cut the tin open. The utility pack was you entered that in a different manner. That was entered by means of a key and a small tab of tin at the side. You would put the key in and you wound it round and round until the top lid come off, which is something similar to the corned beef tins that you get today.
What did you think of the food overall?
It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad at all, really.
Also, with
the rations, we also got 20 cigarettes, 20 Camels or Lucky Strikes, because they were American rations. And in addition to that, we used to get 50 players or gold flake or capstans or something similar issued by the British Army. So we were well stocked up. I mean, we got 200 cigarettes a week, virtually. 140 American and 50 British.
And how was your food cooked?
Whilst we were in reserve and whilst we were on our own, shall we say, in inverted commas, we cooked these over a little trivet, which held a circular meter tablet. This meter tablets, they are, if for want of a better word, they are like a solid methylated spirit block. You lit these with a match, and they flared up, and you stood the tin on the little trivet above it and stirred it, hoping it wouldn't burn. But they were quite effective.
Anything else about your time in reserve?
Whilst we were in reserve, we did establish a cookhouse, and these were a tented cookhouse, and it had a trough more or less down the centre of the tent. And petrol was poured in and set fire to, and the Dixies were still over the top of it, and that we had things like potatoes, vegetables. I can't really recall the meat that we had. I remember at one time, I think it was American Thanksgiving, and they gave us a few turkeys, which the cooks dismembered and actually boiled. Boiled turkey is not my favourite meal, I must say. But however, that was how it was cooked. One time, somebody did shoot one of these Chinese barking deers that occasionally come on in the hills in Korea. And it was gutted and dissected and put into a stew, which was quite quite pleasant to eat.
Now, did you make any special pals in your prison? You weren't with them that long, a couple of 3 months.
That's right. Yeah, I was pretty friendly with Joe Lindsay. I mentioned him in my story. Joe came from.
Was he a private?
He was a private. Yeah, he was the platoon officer's batman, or jeep driver anyway. And Joe came from the Channel Isles, and he was a regular soldier. And he was in the Channel Isles whilst during the German occupation, and he was made to work for the Germans, and he got a fair smattering of the German language, so much so that whilst the Royal Norfolks were in Germany prior to going to Korea, Joe acted as interpreter for some of the Germans that came over the border from East Germany to West Germany, and he excelled himself quite well. Joe, he was our jeep driver.
Any other pals?
Sorry?
Any other particular pals?
Yeah, chap named John Byfield. He was a Londoner and a plumber, so obviously from being in the building trade, we'd got a bit in common. And whilst we were in reserve, we had the opportunity to send two or three men down to the gym to have a swim, a bit of relaxation. And the idea, obviously, was to share it out amongst the platoon. And it usually fell my lot to detail or ask for two men to go down, or three men to go down to the gym. And it was only seemed like Joe and Johnny Byfield that were interested in swimming, apart from myself. So every couple of days or so, the three of us would go down to the gym and swim in the water in the buff, and generally have a good time for an hour or so.
What was it like swimming in the river?
It was a bit cold, actually, but at the centre of the river, where it went down the main channel, that was quite fast flowing, although obviously not so fast flowing as it was at the melt time, you know. But it was pretty cold, but in the more placid parts of the river, where it went into little bays, it got reasonably a reasonable temperature, and we had quite a laugh.
Now, they went back into the line, I think, on the 19th of April.
I think that was it, yeah.
There were anything else before that happened, or is that, have we about covered?
No, we used to go out. We went out on a couple of patrols looking for infiltrators behind.
While you were in reserve.
While we were in reserve.
Tell me about that then.
Well, there'd been rumours of infiltrators coming through the lines and setting up some sort of communication positions behind the lines, and a couple of patrols of us went out and to look for these, but we in old positions where old trenches were and that sort of thing, but we never found anybody at all. One amusing incident there, that when we we were rooting about in one of these old bunkers, and we found one of these that I've mentioned before, a nesting beehive. This was an American type of explosive charge, and it was, as I say, it was cone shaped, and the cone in the bottom that inverts upon explosion. It was made of glass, and the glass was broken. So obviously it rendered the thing unusable, and so we wanted to make it to brew up. So Johnny Byfield and I set to work on this thing with our bayonets, and prized the outer cover off, which was made of a sort of hardboard, and proceeded to chop this high explosive up into chunks to put on the fire. Some of the lads that came out with us were just ordinary infantrymen, and quite alarmed by us breaking this explosive up, and they disappeared very rapidly and didn't realise that a high explosive is not dangerous unless it's put together with an initiatory charge to make it explode. It's highly flammable, but not really dangerous in that sort of situation. It has to have a shock charge to actually explode it. Anyway, shortly after being in reserve, we moved up to Hill 355.
This is in the Koang Sang area.
That's right, that's Hill 355, yeah. And Hill 355 at that time was occupied by the Welch Regiment, and the Assault Pioneer Platoon was seconded to the Welch Regiment to give them support. And we were put onto a nasty little position out in the front of 355. We called it the frying pan, but I believe it had another name. Yes, the other name was Crete, and this was a forward position, forward of 355, 200 or 300 yards in front, I would say, and this consisted of a circular hill with bunkers on the reverse slopes, and crawl trenches around it.
What do you mean by crawl trenches? Can you just explain?
Well, a communications trench, really, so that one could traverse round the hill without being seen by the enemy. And to the fore of the hill, dug in, was a part of the machine gun platoon, commanded by at that time Corporal Pettit. And one of my old friends was part of the machine gun platoon, Michael Griffin. They were in support of us, because we used to have to go forward from Crete down to a listening post about 800 yards out into, or 600 yards out into no man's land. This was just a series of foxhole slots, and we used to go out in groups of 8 or 10 for part of the night. Either we would do from dusk till 12, and then from 12 till dawn, obviously listening for any enemy movement.
What was it like? Did you ever do that?
Yeah.
What was it like?
It was very nerve-wracking. There is no doubt about that. And one used to hear noises in the night which sounded like battalions of an enemy, but obviously wasn't, you know. One of our patrols went out and got attacked one night. A couple of guys got wounded. A chap named Bert Smith, who was a bit of a hard case, he got some shrapnel in him. And a young chap named Varney, who came from somewhere in Norfolk, he got a few scratches, but nothing major. The corporal in charge was Corporal Woodhouse. He was a regular soldier. My immediate superior was a corporal named Jack Aisbitt. Or Naisbitt, I'm not quite sure. And he and I used to split a section between us, and one of us would go out for half the night, and the other one would take would relieve us, you know, either at midnight, or I would relieve him at midnight with a half a dozen blokes. Another corporal in our platoon comes from Ipswich, was Peter Segger, who I made firm friends with whilst I was in the army, but unfortunately since then we've not met up. To be out on a listening patrol is quite traumatic. There's no doubt about it that your nerves are jangling on edge all the time you're out there, because you're completely on your own except for a field telephone, which you hardly dare speak into in case the enemy heard you and you gave your position away, and it was and you felt completely isolated and very vulnerable. Anyway, we stuck that whilst we were there. As I say, we were attached to the Welch Regiment, and they had got a different method of issuing the sea rations, the American sea rations. They formed a cookhouse at the back of 355, which we used to have to walk to, which was a matter of, I suppose, nearly half a mile. And we would go in twos and threes, and the tins of meat, whether they be corned beef hash or meatballs or in gravy or frankfurters and beans, etc., etc., these would be cooked in the tins, not a billy can,
Dixie.
In a Dixie of boiling water, and they would be handed out morning, noon, and night. The upsetting part about it all was that we never ever saw our utility packs, and they didn't issue the American cigarettes. So where they went, I don't know. Perhaps the quartermaster staff would be able to tell you that, but I don't know where they are now, obviously. But we never got the cigarettes, we never got the utility packs, there was no toilet paper, no sweets, no chocolate, no jam and biscuits, just the bare bones of three tins of meat a day. We had a corporal, Lance Corporal, who was attached to Headquarter Company back in B Echelon, and he used to come to our platoon two or three times a week and get some supplementary rations for us, which we had to pay from the forward nappy position. And we would buy bars of chocolate, odd packets of cigarettes, a few sweets, and this sort of thing. We used to pay for it by BAF, BAF, which is British Armed Forces money, and he would take our orders, take our money, and bring us our sweets back, which supplemented our rations. We were there.
We wouldn't. Was there much fighting during this period?
No, very little, very little. We got an occasional mortar came over, but it was pretty stalemate, and mostly just these probing patrols. We never actually went out on a fighting patrol from this position, but we did these listening patrols every night. There was three sections in the company. And so, you know, it's your turn every third night you went out, either midnight or dusk till midnight or midnight till dawn.
Now, this was a period when, I mean, collectively you were known as E Company, according to the history, you know, the forces that were attached to...
The Welsh.
Did you know that at the
Not
time?
Not really, no. No, a couple of us did get seconded up onto Koeng Sang to blast some crawl trenches through some very difficult hillside where it was all rocks.
Tell us about that. That was while you should have been... While you were on Crete.
We were on Crete, yeah. As we were sort of pioneer platoon, the CO of the Welsh Regiment, he realised that we were, shall we say, specialists in explosives. So he asked for a couple of men, an NCO and a man or two men, to go up and blast through this rock to make these communication trenches. And Johnny Byfield and myself went up, I think with one other man, but I can't remember who at the time. I know John was one of my particular friends, so I would remember him, obviously. And we would prepare a charge, put it under a lump of rock, wire it up, and retire to a safe distance while it blew this rocks up. And then there was a few infantrymen there with shovels and the hands, and they would actually clear these rocks away, and then they would move off whilst we laid the next charge and so on. This went on for two or three days, I suppose. This was in addition to us being on duty on Crete.
So it was a quiet period while you were on Crete?
Fairly quiet, yes. We did get one or two. We got a mortar bomb, a couple of stray mortar bombs that came over.
How was that? Would be your first time under proper fire. What was it like under a bit of mortar fire?
Well, uncomfortable, really. Fortunately, it wasn't too near us, so I mean, it was obviously disturbing, but nobody was hurt. The hillside in front of us was absolutely peppered with anti-personnel mines, which the Americans had laid to no particular pattern or plan. And prior to us going there, prior to the winter, there had been an attack on the hillside, and some Chinese had been killed. And as the snow melted and it started to thaw out, then the bodies that were lying there started to ripen up a bit.
And what hill would this be?
This would be on Crete.
It was still part of Crete?
Still part of Crete. And Lieutenant Wormold and myself and two other men went out with some bags of sandbags of earth. And we walked through this minefield looking out for tripwires, etc., and covered the nearest of the bodies up to try and keep the smell down where they were decomposing.